colleagues, comrades. oh, I thought you'd like the comrades bit, you know. Well, you know, I look back to the heady days of the 1970s and sort of radicalism when I was a student. We were all comrades then. Thank you for coming along to this second colloquium that I've organised to give an opportunity for many of us in the university to hear the views of some of the thought leaders in the rapidly changing higher education environment in which we're now operating. And today I'm delighted to be able to welcome Professor Trevor Gale to talk to us about a broad range of equity issues, which are going to be fundamental, I think, to how Australian higher education responds to the government's agenda, the 2040 agenda, 20% of students from low SES households and 40% of 25 to 34-year-olds holding a bachelor's degree by 2025. These are very challenging targets. In fact, I think the low SES target is probably the more difficult one to for the sector to respond to, at least given what we see about the track record over the last 10 years or more, where the proportion of students from low SES households hasn't really changed at all. So there has been significant failure, and the challenge for the sector is how to turn that failure into success, and to do so in a very short space of time, particularly in a business which is actually pretty slow to change. It's slow to change because the time period between a student or a school student thinking about university, then applying to university, being admitted, completing their studies, you know, it's probably a minimum of 4 years, more likely 5 years, before changing something at the school end, before you see any outcomes in terms of graduation. So really, if we are to meet the government's targets, we've got to see major change in higher education over the next 5 or 6 years to meet those targets, which start clocking in 2020. Trevor is Professor of Education and the founding director of the National Centre for Student Equity in Higher Education at the University of South Australia. Previously, he was Associate Dean for Research Degrees in the Faculty of Education at Monash, and there he taught a number of courses, including the Sociology of Teaching, Policy Sociology, and Qualitative Research Methodology. Trevor's got very broad knowledge of the tertiary education sector. He's a founding member of the National VET Equity Advisory Council, the founding editor of Critical Studies in Education, and on the editorial board of the International Journal of Inclusive Education. He is also, and this is particularly important at present, he is one of the, as I said at the beginning, one of the key thought leaders and advisors to the government as the efforts are being made to establish a new way of addressing the equity issue in higher education. So, Trevor, we will be hanging on every word as you talk to us about challenging Australian higher education. Three places to begin. Trevor Gale.
Well, thank you, Paul, for that very generous introduction. I do want to begin with a couple of announcements. I have a few pamphlets which were on a table over there. I think the table's still there. One is about the centre, if you're interested in what the work of the centre, what they're doing, including a website that the centre is establishing online for discussion and also for the dissemination of research and programs and policies in this space. So that's there. Our second newsletter, the first one didn't look as glossy as this one, so that's our second newsletter. We hope there will be many more. And also some information about an event that the National Centre is running in Adelaide. And I suspect that many of you would find that probably a little bit hard to achieve to get over there just for that evening event. But I thought I would bring along anyway, and just in case that some of you might be interested in that. We do hold events around the country. Last week we had a conference in Sydney called the Social Inclusion Education Conference. And indeed, earlier this year we held a workshop at La Trobe University where I think I met Gary for the first time and a number of other equity practitioners and other people interested in equity issues from around the universities in Victoria. So we are trying to run those events, not just where we're located in Adelaide, but certainly around the country. So I want to begin today by thanking Professor Johnson for this opportunity to rehearse and indeed expand on the comments I made earlier this year at the Universities Australia meeting of Vice-Chancellors in Brisbane. My comments then and now are in part speculative, given that they comment on what might be, although they are also informed and cognizant of what we already know about student equity issues in higher education, including the research that's been undertaken by the National Centre, but also research available more widely, both nationally and internationally. So informed by this work, the central thesis that I want to put to you today and to open up for discussion is that if the Australian higher education sector is to take seriously the federal government's 2040 targets, which Paul has informed us about earlier, then there are three main challenges that we need to confront. First, that the expansion of higher education provision of a particular mix will need to be done in the context of limited excess student demand, certainly compared to previous periods of expansion by the sector. Second, that the 2040 targets have brought into sharp relief the problems with our current set of definitions and measurements of students, of equity groups, including those from socioeconomic status, but also student achievement and aspiration. And thirdly, that universities will need to confront the teaching and learning that is higher education. This is the very thing, or at least one of them, that we would hope students might aspire to in coming to university. Now, for me, it's difficult to signal out any one of these areas as more important than the others or put them in some sort of hierarchy. But if push came to shove, I suppose I would probably nominate the first of these, the problems around expanding the system in the context of low unmet student demand, because this tends to drive, in my view, the other two. And it also has the potential to be the most promising in terms of access for underrepresented groups. Research in the US suggests that the participation of low SES people in university is more likely to increase in proportional terms when unmet student demand is low, and less likely to increase proportionally when unmet student demand is high. Well, while the former is yet to be proven in Australia, the latter has certainly been evident. People from low SES backgrounds have not increased their representation in Australian higher education during periods of system expansion. If we are truly in a low unmet student demand period, the current proposed expansion of higher education will be like no other in Australia's history. In the past, the primary driver for expanding higher education has been the demand for places, significantly exceeding their supply. Reforms to Australian higher education under Whitlam and Dawkins are classic examples. But unmet demand for higher education has been trending down. While unmet demand is currently at 8%, or 18,500 people, before the effect of the global financial crisis, it was 6%. And falling. I suspect that if the worst of the GFC is past us, and if all else remains equal, we may see these numbers return to trend. Of course, this is unmet student demand. It's not student demand per se. In the noughties, the rise and fall of unmet student demand was roughly matched by the fall and rise in the supply of places. That is, throughout the decade, student demand for university places has been fairly constant. The number one challenge, then, confronting Australian higher education, would seem to be to encourage and enable people to seek university entry from among those who currently do not. In Victoria, the situation is perhaps a little brighter. Unmet demand in the state has more or less followed the national average, although at a slightly higher rate. For example, in 2009, unmet student demand in Victoria was running a little under 11%, or around 6,400 people. At these levels, there is room for some expansion in the higher education provision, but not that much, and not enough to shift the proportion of 25 to 34-year-olds Australians with bachelor's degrees from 32% in 2008 to the 40% target by 2025. Kwong Lee Dow's group, which is currently charged with developing a tertiary education plan for Victoria, has estimated that in order for us to meet the federal government's 40% attainment target, student enrolments in Victoria, in Victorian universities alone, would need to increase by at least 10,000 students and probably 12,000 students. Now, that's an increase of 22% on the 2009 Victorian intake, twice as much as its current unmet demand, which, as I've argued before, is temporarily inflated by the global financial crisis. Now, to put this in a national perspective, by 2025, Australia will require expansion to the system of about 4 to 5 times the size of Monash University, currently the largest university in Australia, at around 50,000 students. So what can universities do to address the problem of low numbers of eligible students waiting in the wings, so to speak, to soak up the proposed higher education expansion? I have heard some senior university managers suggest that universities could adjust the mix of their student enrolments to ensure that more of their undergraduates are enrolled in and complete bachelor's degrees. This could possibly help at the margins of student attainment targets, but it is hardly a strategy to address the massive increases required. I have also heard others say that improving student retention rates to levels near 100% would solve attainment-related targets without any need to attract currently unattracted students. Now, improving retention rates, as I'm sure you are aware from the laughter around the room, is a much harder task, certainly if we're going to look at absolute retention, and if achieved, would stand apart from other higher education systems around the globe. And as I've indicated earlier, we could also anticipate that the global financial crisis will act to temporarily increase demand, some of which has already been absorbed by universities, bulking up on their mid-year entry students in anticipation of the staged removal of volume caps. But these entrants are more likely to be mature-age students who will not directly contribute to the 40% target. The 25 to 34-year-olds of 2025 are currently 9 to 18 years of age. Most are still at school and being required by law and encouraged through financial disincentives to stay longer. Yet, if the younger end of this cohort follows their siblings, interest in participating in higher education would seem to be waning. 15 to 19-year-old Australians are now more likely to be out of education or employment than their OECD peers, particularly those in the European Union. With respect to the kind of education that would enable young Australians to qualify for university, more, in absolute terms, are staying on at school to complete Year 12, as the top graph indicates. But because of the growing population, Year 12 students increasingly represent a smaller proportion of their age cohort. So that doesn't help us when we've got percentages as the targets. The important point to note here is that these figures relate to Year 12 students and do not include their equivalents. Year 12 equivalence has undergone something of a revision in recent times, in part in response to the federal government's target of 90% retention rate to Year 12 or equivalent by 2015. In shifting their retention target from 2020 to 2015, a shift that was initiated by government, the definition of Year 12 equivalence has shifted from Certificate 3 to Certificate 2. This is the kind of manipulation that has allowed Victoria to claim it has already met the 90% Year 12 or equivalent retention target. Yet neither Certificate 3 nor Certificate 2 are highly regarded by universities as as preparation for university entry. In fact, Certificate 4 in adult tertiary preparation, which is currently offered by several TAFEs around the country, is more in keeping with university entry requirements. It is clear that many of the 15 to 19-year-olds not staying on at school are moving on to VET. Indeed, the rise in VET participation since 2004 can be attributed mainly to an increased participation of this particular age group, which now represents 30% of all VET students. You might look at the other figures there too, and you'll see that they've been staying fairly much the same, while it's that one age group that's been increasing over that time. In fact, it is important to note that only 20% of VET students are enrolling in courses that articulate with university, 10% in Certificate 4 courses, and a further 10% in Diploma and Above courses. In short, VET currently provides a very narrow route to higher education that will not simply be addressed by a better Australian qualifications framework, and may well be diminished further in Victoria by the introduction of a HECS-style fees now applied to VET courses that articulate with university. The proposed expansion of Australian higher education will also be like no other, because it is required to more than equally benefit people from low socioeconomic backgrounds. As I mentioned earlier, in the past, when governments have increased the supply of higher education, the absolute number of low SES students has increased, but their proportional representation has remained relatively unchanged at around 15%, which Paul mentioned earlier. Under the current proposal, their undergraduate representation is set to rise in absolute terms and also proportionally to 20% by 2020. But just as we can't rely on VET to make up the shortfall in qualified applicants for higher education, neither can VET be relied on to supply higher education with an increased proportion of students from low socioeconomic backgrounds. And I've put in red the important figures there for you to get a sense of that. So you can see on the right-hand side the numbers of people who are enrolled in a Certificate 4 is 10.4% of the total number of VET students. The number of people enrolled in a diploma and higher course in VET is 10.3% of all VET students. The other figure, 9.2% of all those doing a Certificate 4 are from low SES backgrounds, whereas 6.8% of all VET students doing a diploma and above course are from low SES backgrounds. They are not coming to us in any greater number than they are coming to us from school. The same can be said about Indigenous peoples. They are overrepresented in VET courses, as the recent NCVR figures illustrated, at 4.7% of all VET students compared to 2.4% of all Australians. But only 6% of all Indigenous VET students are enrolled in diploma or above courses that articulate with higher education. In short, VET will not currently deliver disadvantaged students to universities in the numbers it desires or requires. So the first issue then that confronts us is that an increase in university student numbers will mean a new accounting of student achievement and aspiration, with aspiration now receiving higher prominence. Now, some universities could conceivably offer more places and continue to trade solely in school results, or that is student achievement or enter scores, but it would mean that their expansion would come at the cost of the enrolments in other universities. Most will need to engage with students' aspirations. In the past, student aspirations have remained largely in the background. Excesses in student demand have mediated competition between universities. "Our university is the place for you" has been the mantra of most university marketing departments. That's still an important message, but it now needs to be balanced against a new one. That is, university is a place for you. To achieve the sector's targets, Australian universities will need to find ways in which to work collaboratively to address the more basic problem of an insufficient supply of qualified applicants. And indeed, the elephant in the room in all of this is what individual institutions and institutional collectives will do. For example, while most GO8 universities have indicated that they have no plans to expand, apart from Adelaide and the UWA, both Melbourne and Sydney, the two oldest universities in the country, have signalled that they plan to downsize their undergraduate intakes. In particular, the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Sydney has recently noted that, by elite university standards, Sydney currently has a large undergraduate student enrolment. Now, I invite you to read between the lines. In fact, you probably don't need to read between the lines very long, because the green paper, a green paper from the university, is about to be released in the next couple of weeks. If the USA research in relation to access to university by low SES groups is borne out in Australia and in individual institutions, then we can expect that increasing the demand for elite universities by reducing the places they make available is unlikely to contribute to an increased representation of low SES students in those institutions. Was that perhaps a little bit too subtle? While such moves have the potential to shift supply and have related effects on student demand and participation at both undergraduate and postgraduate levels, they do not change the underlying problem facing the sector as a whole of not enough interested and qualified applicants to meet the government's 2040 targets. Both the achievement and aspirations of students prior to entering higher education will need to be the focus of increased and concerted efforts by universities. And until recently, most of this effort has been focused on students in years 11 and 12, at the time when achievement and aspirations had been largely set. More needs to be done earlier in school, at least from the upper end of primary school, when patterns of achievement and aspiration that lead to university are being formed. The research suggests that the best payoffs for investment in higher education are when student support begins as early as possible and continues for as long as possible. Given the 2040 targets and the context in which they are to be achieved, it is in the interest of universities to be involved in partnership with schools to achieve such ends, and we might also argue with TAFEs and other VET providers. Indeed, universities are already involved in influencing school curriculum. They have been for a very long time, and involved in producing the teachers who implement that curriculum. We cannot wash our hands from participating in this problem. But targeted interventions early in schooling will need to be strategic, comprised of particular characteristics and an unambiguous equity orientation. The National Centre has recently completed research for the government on how to design and evaluate effective programs of this kind. Conducted in four stages, the research found that the overall likely effectiveness of a program depends on its strength of composition and on the degree to which it is supported by an equity orientation towards policy and practice. Specifically, it suggested that programs that are quite likely to increase the number of disadvantaged students going on to higher education than otherwise would have been the case exhibit at least 4 from 10 design characteristics, 3 from 4 implementation strategies, and 2 from 3 equity perspectives. Now, the full report is soon to be released on DWA's website within the next week or so. So I invite you, if you're interested, to chase that up. And it's an 80,000-word report. But there is an executive summary at the beginning, which might be of some help to you. The second challenge that the sector faces concerns its current set of definitions and measurements of equity groups, but also student achievement and aspiration. So consider, for example, how we currently think about and measure socioeconomic status. This is particularly important because universities across the country are now being asked to lift their game to raise the number of low SES status Australians enrolled in their institutions to 20% by 2020. This is both a target for the sector, with variation across institutions contributing to the overall result, and, as I now want to go on to elaborate, a catch-all for all underrepresented groups, particularly Indigenous peoples and people from regional and remote areas. Now, for me, there are at least three questions that arise for policy and practice from current statistical precision that is applied to the conception of equity. And in our current policy environment, they tend to be pursued primarily in relation to socioeconomic status. Now, they are, as you can see there, how can we account for differences between equity groups? How can we, indeed, should we, account for differences within equity groups? And how confident can we be that we are measuring what we're claiming to measure? The first question speaks to the issue of the relative importance between equity groups. In the Bradley Review and in the federal government's response, low socioeconomic status appears to have become an umbrella term for all underrepresented groups, including not only low SES people, but also Indigenous peoples and people from regional and remote areas. Now, while it's true that many Indigenous and regional and remote people are from low SES backgrounds, it is also the case that many are not. For example, at least one third of Indigenous students are not eligible for the Youth Support Allowance. Moreover, even those who are from low SES backgrounds, these backgrounds do not describe in full their particular social and cultural circumstances. Australia's Indigenous population rightly claims its distinctiveness in Australian society as first Australians, as having legitimate claims to and relationships with the land, as having distinctive values, understandings, practices and rights. Now, to its credit, the government's recent budget paper, Transforming Australia's Higher Education System, announced its intention to support a review of the effectiveness of measures to improve the participation of Indigenous students. Nonetheless, the government is still of the view, and I quote, that the steps to improve low SES student participation will impact on and benefit Indigenous students. The same concessions have not been afforded people from regional and remote areas of Australia, despite the fact that of all equity groups, their participation in higher education has seen the largest reduction over time. In effect, in the current equity policy hierarchy, Indigenous people and people from regional and remote areas are located first and second, respectively, under the low SES banner, while students with disabilities are less conveniently subsumed and indeed displaced from current policy debates. Now, the second issue, or the second question then, that arises from our current policy settings is the way in which people from low socioeconomic backgrounds are conceived as a homogenous group. There are, in fact, distinct differences within this grouping that again are derived from their different social and cultural differences. Refugees, for example, are a quite different group from the second and third generation unemployed of Anglo heritage. Take language, which we know is intimately related to culture, as just one example of these differences. For some, English as a third or fourth language is a third or fourth language, and for others, they may have difficulty in mastering English as their first language. And there are other examples of differences within this cohort that I'm sure that you could cite as well. The third issue here that I and others have with this narrow statistical approach to defining socioeconomic status involves the question of precision in how SES is measured. Not very well, some might say. We currently use an ABS-generated measure of the employment and educational attainment of individuals within postcodes, which are then rated from highest to lowest. Those postcodes in the bottom quartile, the bottom 25%, and by association those people living inside those postcodes are deemed to be of low socioeconomic status. Now, one of the problems with this measure is that it does not take account of wealthy and high status areas within those low SES postcodes or of poorer and lower status areas in middle and high SES postcodes. I, in fact, used to live in a suburb called Frankston. You can buy a house in Frankston for around $200,000. You also can buy a house in Frankston for $2 to $3 to $4 to $5 million. They are quite different within the one postcode. Now, so naturally, vice chancellors are concerned about the lack of clarity around these issues, particularly those who believe that their current student populations include students from low SES backgrounds and who originate from and or live in the middle and high SES postcodes. You may have heard Stephen Parker, the vice chancellor of the University of Canberra, making this very point. Vice chancellors are also concerned about the compacts that each institution will be required to establish with the government in 2010. Which will include institutional commitments to meeting certain targets related to the improved participation of students from low SES backgrounds. A university may well be in a position where, in effect, it is able to meet its target, but this may not be represented within the official statistics. And again, the University of Canberra is a classic example of that. Now, in recognition of these difficulties, the government has advised that it intends to revise the way in which low SES is currently measured for higher education participation purposes. They will most likely include taking account of smaller areas within postcodes called collection districts. It may also combine this with data on students' parental education attainment, which DEWA is requiring universities to collect from students from 2010. Another possible measure could be derived from youth support allowance data available from Centrelink, and particularly now that the government is committed to cleaning up the eligibility criteria to exclude those students whose financial circumstances don't warrant that support. To be worthy of our trust, I think that any new measure of low SES status needs to be cognizant of at least three things. And I've listed them there, but the first is that it needs to be defined by its context. The second, that it needs to involve a combination rather than rely on one single measure, given that it's such a complex concept. And thirdly, that we should regard these measures as indicative rather than prescriptive. They tend to indicate rather than prescribing exactly. And as I have already noted, the government has recently commented that better measures of low socioeconomic status will be developed, which are based on the circumstances of individual students and their families. However, the value of the current and arguably flawed measure is its regard for context, and it is not purely derived from economic considerations, although certainly one's employment speaks to that. The danger in any new measure is that it becomes so focused on individuals and their individual circumstances that it loses any sense of the influence of these individuals' socio-cultural contexts and which constitute the group. In developing new measure of socioeconomic status, and I would argue this also needs to account for mid and high as well as low socioeconomic status, because wealth and poverty tend to be relative terms in advanced economies, the government would do well not to lose sight of family and community, and I would argue context. We need to avoid reducing socioeconomic status to a single measure of an individual's financial and/or educational attainment alone. Now, a further aspect of this challenge is to our current set of definitions concerns the way in which universities determine who is selected for entry. Now, you would be well aware that this has received considerable attention in Victoria and other parts of the country too, but particularly in Victoria. The evidence from this research is finally getting through that ENTR scores are highly correlated with socioeconomic status, as Richard Teese and John Polsell at the University of Melbourne have identified in their research, and this comes from their work. The TER is an authoritative measure that rewards the cultural resources characteristic of the most economically powerful groups in society. Moreover, there are any number of studies, small and large scale, which demonstrate that when students from low SES backgrounds gain access to university, their retention rates and their academic performances are at or about the same as their higher ENTR score peers. The emerging Victorian solution to this measurement and selection problem is to replace or at least displace ENTR scores through the wide-scale introduction of aptitude tests, or at least this is one of the things that's been mooted. Aptitude tests are not new to Australia and not new to Australian higher education. And here's some of the examples in which it's currently being used. The espoused virtues of aptitude tests is that they are school-proof to the extent that they are able to measure a person's ability in a way that is not influenced by prior education attainment, the quality of the education, or socioeconomic background. For example, the uni test, which is of current interest to the Victorian government, advises students thus. The purpose of the uni test is to assess the generic reasoning and thinking skills that underpin studies at higher education. For this reason, the uni test has been developed as a test that is not based on learned academic curriculum or study of particular subjects, but as a test of your response to stimulus that will not necessarily be familiar. And yet, despite claims that aptitude tests cannot be studied for, research from the USA and the UK show that preparatory courses and coaching for aptitude tests do exist, and that students from more affluent backgrounds more often have the economic, social, and cultural resources to access this preparation. For example, Stringer notes that in the USA, many affluent parents enrolled their children in preparation courses. In the year 2000, an estimated 150,000 students, and just get this, 150,000 students paid over $100 million for aptitude test coaching and preparation. Moreover, aptitude tests are more likely to assess skills and understandings informed by knowledge to which the more affluent have greater access, even before receiving explicit coaching. To exclude such knowledge from schooling is to reduce low SES students' access to it and hence diminish their chances of performing well on such tests. The strong evidence from the research literature is that there is no evidence to suggest that aptitude tests alone provide a more predictive power of university achievement than curriculum-based tests alone. And as Thies and Possel note with regard to ENTR scores, aptitude tests are just as indicative of socioeconomic status and no better than ENTR scores at predicting future academic achievement. However, the fact remains that we need to develop measures of student potential in which we can have confidence and which do not preclude capable students from entering university. The research literature, again, suggests that a combination of quantitative and qualitative measures, in addition to a mechanism that measures and ranks educational achievement in context, is the way forward. Indeed, many Australian universities already use such measures to determine an applicant's potential to achieve at university, albeit at the margin of universities' mainstream selection procedures. Examples of these alternative admission procedures include an applicant's high school grades, extracurricular activities, letters of recommendation from school teachers or principals, interviews and personal statements and essays that indicate an applicant's personal qualities and levels of interest. A whole range of these things, a combination often. Often they're used in combination with ENTR scores, but not exclusively, sometimes in the absence of ENTR scores, moderated sometimes through the addition of bonus ENTR score points, which are calculated according to the variation between scores of similar ability students from advantaged and disadvantaged schools, and justified on the basis that, as, and I quote the recent report from Richard James and his colleagues, compensatory processes in student recruitment and selection will always be necessary to reduce social inequalities. Now, using such methods, colleges in the USA have been able to increase the participation of disadvantaged groups while also maintaining high academic standards. Now, the Australian experience has been similar. At the University of South Australia, for example, nearly 25% of the offers made to school leavers in 2006 were made through these kinds of processes. And at RMIT's Schools Network Access Program, or as it's known as SNAP, which operates in partnership with 70 schools from disadvantaged schools around the state, demonstrates that such programs do not necessarily lead to reduction in academic standards. Indeed, this is a report, a recent report by Millie Fells about this program and the achievement of those students who have come through that program. You will see there that she's indicated that SNAP students, in comparison to their peers, demonstrate a slightly lower level of withdrawal, a higher incidence of credit, comparable distinction grades, and lower levels of high distinction in their first year of study. Now, when she looks at this group across the period, there is a remarkable consistency with patterns of success with the total domestic student population and within different discipline areas. The success of these alternative entry processes illustrated that we already have the mechanisms which are effective in identifying disadvantaged students with the potential to do well at university. Indeed, these mechanisms are able to reveal far more about students than their current enter scores, and they are good reasons to argue that Australian universities should be working towards generalising these more robust methods of student selection across the entire student population, rather than restrict their decision-making to applicants' narrow enter scores. Briefly, a third aspect of the 2040 challenge to definitions and measurements is to develop a more nuanced definition of student aspiration. The dominant view that we need to create aspiration for higher education among disadvantaged groups and encourage them to aim higher is rather condescending. And it misses the point that some people do not see university study as a better option to the aspirations they currently hold. University study is not self-evidently better in terms of cultural identity, life choices, or even economic prosperity. Our conceptions of student aspiration are also ignorant of the fact that many people already aspire to higher education but do not gain or seek entry when the time comes. For example, researchers at Victoria University have found that 70% of secondary school students in Melbourne's low SES western suburbs aspire to go to university, although clearly they are not all attaining that, at least not at the end of their secondary schooling. What we can say about educational aspirations of low SES people is that they tend to be more brittle and, as for all of us, are defined what they understand to be possible, given the social and economic resources they have at hand, and what they understand to be desirable, given the influence of family and culture. We can also say that aspirations are related to the achievement and that both is related to achievement and that both need to be addressed much earlier in schooling than is the case with most current university outreach programs. Now, the third challenge that I see for Australian universities is the need to confront the teaching and learning that constitutes higher education. In the 2009 federal budgets, the government expressed its view that teaching and learning in university requires our attention. The issue is not that universities will need to do better because they'll have more low-qualified students to teach. As I've already noted, the current retention rates for students from low SES backgrounds matches their peers. If retention rates are an issue, they are an issue for all students. But rethinking our teaching and learning needs to go beyond simply targeting retention rates. A more sophisticated approach, as Denise Bradley wrote in her report to student equity in higher education, entails the creation of spaces in universities, not just for new kinds of student bodies, but also the knowledges and ways of knowing that they embody. In the past, there has not been enough regard for what students bring to university, to the learning environment and experience, and for what they are potentially able to contribute, although there are some notable exceptions. For example, international students are now very much part of the landscape of Australian higher education. Their very presence, and in such numbers, has changed Australian higher education, and for the most part, for the better. International students have challenged our epistemologies and ontological assumptions and prompted many Australian academics to rethink and think differently about higher education and what that means and what is being offered to the students who come, not just to those students who come from overseas, but also to domestic students as well. Now, in the same way, people from low socioeconomic backgrounds come to university with sets of knowledges about the world, of what it is and how to engage with it, which are potentially different from and valuable to others. Taking account of this, in fact, understanding that all students bring assets to university will require us to think about how we can structure the learning environment and experience in ways that open it up and make it possible for students to contribute from where they are and what they know. The absence of these contributions from universities means a diminished higher education for our current university students, particularly for those who are part of a more homogeneous university student population. Such absence goes some way to explain why some groups of students don't aspire to university. There is little incentive to join or remain in a system in which you are inevitably positioned as being without. Thinking differently about teaching and learning in higher education is starting to take traction across OECD nations, particularly in the UK, the US, and in Australia. And there are at least three different sets of principles about teaching and learning that have gained currency in this environment, albeit in different higher education systems. Now, in comparing them, three things are worth noting. First, not all principles are the same across these different sectors that have been identified. And they do not agree, these authors do not agree, on the ideal set number. But there are at least three principles that seem to be consistent across each set. So I want to talk about those three for a minute. The narrative that weaves these together is that there is a diversity of learners and ways of learning which need to be taken into account when designing learning and teaching activities. Also, learners learn best when learning activities require them to be actively engaged. And assessment should have a pedagogical intent, making a contribution to students' learning and not just serving as an institutional purpose of allocating targets or grades. Now, these seem eminently sensible, almost motherhood statements which would be hard for anyone to disagree with. They and many of their other principles are also informed by a particular constructivist theory of learning, which posits that people learn through their experiences, through activity and by doing. This is another way of saying that most of these principles share a particular philosophical orientation, which emphasises the role of the individual in the learning process. George Kuh, the founder of the National Survey of Student Engagement, the USA equivalent of the Aussie, provides the perfect and probably extreme illustration of this way of thinking. He has asserted that when we control for factors such as students' socioeconomic backgrounds, parents' education and students' measured level of academic achievement prior to university, it turns out that how much students learn is not a function of who they are. It's a function of what they do. Of course, if we are to take a sophisticated approach to equity, as Denise Bradley encourages us to do, stripping back learning to what individuals do is at the heart of the higher education problematic for equity groups. To think otherwise is to imagine that what people are asked to learn has no bearing on how well they learn it. It fails to take into account that who people are in relationship with others and where they are located has a bearing on what they already know and what they count as worthwhile. It's like imagining that an Indigenous person has no connection with the land other than a European notion of ownership that allows for land to be bought and sold or acquired by force. It is like suggesting to a working class person that knowledge can be generated outside contexts of practice or that contexts of practice rely on abstract knowledge to inform action. In fact, it is hard to imagine how who people are can be disentangled from what they do and enhance what they might learn from the experience. Now, to be fair to these sets of principles, buried in them is a set of principles, at least three, that have a more critical constructivism that move us towards socio-cultural, even political understandings of teaching and learning. And I deliberately want to emphasise what I see as the possibility of an equity principle in each of them. So consider these three: student-faculty contact, which where students are significant in their own terms; informed learning, where students learn things of value outside education systems. In other words, we understand that they have something to contribute to higher education, not simply what they've learned in school or not learned in school. And also research for teaching, which is not research that undermines what to teach, which informs what to teach, but informs the teaching and learning experience, how to engage with different knowledges and ways of knowing, including research about what students know and how they know. Now, one way of translating this acknowledgement of marginalised knowledges into real-world curriculum is what is known as, in the literature, as funds of knowledge, a funds of knowledge approach. This includes recognising that all students come with valuable understandings that can contribute to the education of others. The approach requires identifying and inviting students' knowledges into the learning environment and using them to develop curricula. Students are then positioned differently because they are now experts in that field and able to make informed contributions from that expert position. Lou Zippin has argued that complementing this approach, we also need to identify funds of pedagogy. It's not just the knowledges that students from different socio-cultural groups have, but also the ways in which those students learn in those groups that's taken into account. Finding a way of bringing those into the formal learning environment is far more challenging to the logic of higher education. To bring in different content is one thing. To bring in ways of knowing at a deeper level is more threatening. So, I might leave that for a moment, and certainly that will be on the website for you to have a look at, and I'll skip over that to my next slide, I think. How might we then create spaces for student knowledges in our classrooms? The work that's been done by the Teaching and Learning Research Program in the UK, which is located at the Institute of Education in London, speaks to what they call a connectivist pedagogy, or connectivist deep pedagogies. In their terms, connectivist pedagogies or connectivist deep teaching approaches emphasise all these things on the left, which they juxtapose with transmissionist surface pedagogies that are indicated on the right. I'm sure that we could see, if we translated this to particular experiences that you have had and seen in higher education, that you might see examples of these. They argue that we need to be doing more of this on the left and less of that on the right, if we are to engage with all kinds of students, not just students from disadvantaged backgrounds, but all students, and it will have benefit for all students as well. So let me conclude. The 2040 targets have brought to the fore the problems with the definitions and measures with which we have been working, and they are encouraging us to rethink the ways in which we approach teaching and learning. But most significantly, they have highlighted that expansion to the system to reach the 2040 targets will require a new engagement with Australians who currently have no intention or are without the necessary qualifications to seek access to university. Logically, meeting these sector targets will be extremely difficult for most institutions working in isolation, even for those who have a strong record in this area. And yet the compacts are set to be the subject of a series of individual negotiations. It would make more sense for the problem of the underrepresentation of low SES people in higher education to be addressed by focusing on people in disadvantaged areas rather than on institutional targets, and to encourage universities to work collectively and collaboratively with each other and with people in those areas. The Social Inclusion Board has recently developed a compendium of social inclusion indicators that could be used constructively to identify the areas of greatest disadvantage and social inclusion within Australia, and then to measure progress over time towards their resolution. And the design and evaluation matrix for outreach, which has been developed by the National Centre, could also be used, or something like it, by institutions to inform the development of collective outreach activities into these areas that have the greatest likelihood of success. The compacts to be negotiated with government could then be structured to reward institutions for working in partnerships and in identified areas in ways that the research suggests to be most effective. Not only could this enable universities to collectively meet their longer-term sector-wide targets set by government, it would also support their wider social role in achieving social inclusion. It would, in Denise Bradley's terms, be a more sophisticated approach to student equity. Thank you. Now, I think that we may have time for questions, and I've said... Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon.
Well, thank you very much, Trevor. And often when you come to these things and I look around the room, we often preach to the choir. But I think one of the challenges for us is to leave the colloquium today and go and tell at least five people to look the presentation up on the web. Please feel free to email me the names of the people you've told. I may have jobs for them later. Trevor, thank you very much, because I think it's, you know, you've listed some challenges for us, and at La Trobe, you know, we've done a lot of talking around many of these issues, particularly in relation to, you know, where are these people going to come from in the realities of, you know, the statistical realities of achieving these percentage-based targets. Your challenge about the measurement of low SES, because I acknowledge Stephanie Chard and her staff in the room who are often talking about low SES students coming with multiple disadvantages. And, you know, it is not a homogenous group that is coming into the university. Thank you very much for raising the idea of how we approach entry methods, and particularly around TER. And I know that many people in the room who are part of the, SARS, the SARS committee, I've had some discussions around that. I think it's incredibly important that on today, which is World Teachers Day, Australia observes World Teachers Day on the last Friday in November versus the rest of the world that does it on the first Friday in November, because often our teachers are on holidays when the rest of the world is acknowledging it. But I think the lessons that you've put up are about good teaching is good teaching. And that, you know, we challenge every day in our classes to approach curriculum from a variety of ways because of the diversity in our classrooms. And I'm also struck by the need to change language. And I think you've alluded to some of that today, in that we have to stop talking about deficit and disadvantage, and we've got to come from it approach it from a way of what are the contributions that these students will bring and make to our institution. I think there are some questions that, you know, we will still need to bed down in terms of you know, how we're doing things and how we know we're doing things well, and you know, the support of programs and how we know these programs are working. And, you know, are we selling what these groups want to be sold? And the idea of aspiration is that you raised today is particularly striking in my mind. In the Indigenous community, we often talk about the three M's, and it's essentially around bad service delivery. We talk about the missionaries, the misfits, and the mercenaries who come into communities and do things to Aboriginal people. One of the challenges is that we need to remember in a social inclusion equity agenda that the university is a lot of things. It's labs and teaching spaces and offices and computers and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, it's people. People doing things with other people. So in an equity agenda, when we start talking about these issues, whether they're students from disadvantaged backgrounds, Indigenous students, students with disability, it is about approaching our programs and developing them from the perspective of, you know, can I see our shared humanity in this? So thank you very much, Trevor, and much appreciated. And please go out and tell five of your friends.
We have some time, not much time, but a bit of time for questions to Trevor. If you could keep your questions nice and concise, that would be appreciated. You need to ask them into the microphone so they can be recorded. So, questions, over to you.
If I may, please. Thank you, Trevor. It was very interesting. Very interesting, in fact. All these things come at a cost, and I guess that's my question. Do we have any idea how, as a nation, we intend to address the cost of addressing some of these very important issues?
The cost of not addressing them or the cost
well,
of addressing them?
The cost works both ways, I think, doesn't it? Against our OECD partners, because we're not doing it, it's become evident.
Yes, it depends. I mean, the rationale that's been put up about why we should be playing in this way, playing the game in this way, is that we need to be participating in a knowledge economy and moving out of an industrial economy. And when the global economy starts to recover, presumably there will be knowledge jobs that we want Australians to access. We need to have Australians ready to access those knowledge jobs. I mean, this is the rhetoric that the government's put up, and you might want to poke holes in that logic, but there's a sense in which the government is of the view that we are rapidly losing jobs that were related to an industrial economy. If we don't do anything to help Australians move out of that economy into a knowledge economy, we will relegate many numbers of Australians to not having a job at all, or if they want the job, they'll need to go to China or India to get it. So this is about the cost of not acting, I think, as much as about the cost of what it is to act. And the costs aren't simply financial, they're also social and cultural. There is great cost for people who currently are members of the elite group of our society. They see a great cost, and indeed they work in ways to maintain their position in society. Now, we can't just fight against that. We need to engage with them in those conversations and help them to understand the intent of these things and their worthwhileness as well. So I know I've skirted around your question. The government has put up a certain amount of money to try and encourage universities to participate in this new game. For some institutions, I think it's not enough. It's not enough of an incentive, just the money alone. And that's why we can't talk just about the money alone. It also has to be about these other things, to encourage people to engage in this way of... to engage in this expansion of the system, and indeed to engage in expanding the participation of people from disadvantaged backgrounds.
I'm very interested in what you're talking about, aspirations for university. Yeah. One of our staff went out to a school that's in our catchment area and spoke to 25 refugee students from a Congolese background and was appalled to find out that not one of them thought they could afford to go to university. Mm. And in fact, the careers teacher had discouraged them all from going to university on the basis of their lack of language skills.
Yeah.
And many of these students were actually hoping. You talked about the, you know, the background aspirations, but the fall off. And It just said to me that there's a whole lot of work that needs to be done, and a huge amount of work with our teachers, with our secondary schools, and with the students within those schools to help them to view university as a possibility and not to take them off that track to university. And what can a university do with its limited resources to address some of those large issues that are not actually in our sector, I think?
Mm. You're right to point out the problems. I'm sure we all could find stories of the ways in which this is not working. I want to talk about, and I hope that we can all talk about the ways in which it can work. One of the ways it needs to work is for us to work in partnership with schools. Certainly there have been targets set by government and agreed to by state governments four targets for schooling, including the national partnership around the participation of low SES students in schools and around their school communities. So there are targets around that. There are targets around Indigenous participation in schooling, perhaps not as many as we'd like. But this is to say that the attention of schooling has been focused on these matters as much as the higher education sector has. I've been saying of recent times that we also need to focus the attention of the TAFE and VET sector in these matters, and certainly the establishment of a National VET Equity Advisory Council does that in part, perhaps not as much as we would like. But in response to your question, my response is that we need to work more collaboratively with our colleagues in other education sectors. We can't stand aloof and say we'll deliver to our door the low SES students in the way we would like them and say that it's your responsibility to do that. We can't do anything at all. I know our resources are limited, but we can't take that position, because as soon as we do that, we just perpetuate the problem. The way out of this problem, I think, is a collaborative one and involves partnerships with schools. And on that point of language, I really appreciate Gary raising this thing about the way in which we talk about these issues. It's very, very important. It's a political move as much as anything else. People talk about aiming higher and creating aspirations where we know, as you've indicated, that people do have real aspirations. And I've started to talk about frustrated aspirations, because it shifts the conversation. It actually draws attention to institutions and systems that frustrate the aspirations of the people that you mentioned. And we know that individuals are part of those institutions, but if we can help them to think about those people, assuming that they do have an aspiration for a better life, whatever that might entail, and working with them to try and help them achieve that.
Thank you very much for your talk. I really appreciated it. And I was thinking particularly about some of the things that you were saying about the potential to renew pedagogy. And as you, I'm sure you know, at La Trobe, we've got this big curriculum renewal underway. And it seems to me that a major challenge for all of us to think about is really thinking about ways to value the spending of time with students, and perhaps to rethink the way that we currently perhaps value efficiency in terms of valuing teaching effectiveness.
Yes, this is a really important issue. I know at the beginning I hung my flag to the mast on the first point about getting people into university, but what we do at university, and indeed what university is being challenged here as well, and the whole issue around what happens in university classrooms is central to this issue, and I'm pleased and I recognise that many other universities are actually having reviews of their curriculum as well, and this is an appropriate time to do that in my view. The issues are about how we position students in relation to the field of knowledge that we're engaged in the discipline, and indeed in their relation to the university. If we position them as empty vessels that come in, that we just pour the knowledge into and we pump them out the other end, it's not a very enjoyable educational experience for them. Indeed, are they getting an education? It seems to me that we need to recognise that they already come to us with understandings, and that those understandings need to be valued. It doesn't mean to say that you need to abdicate responsibility as an expert in your field, as a teacher in that discipline. You certainly have an expertise. You certainly do have a responsibility to pass that expertise on as much as you're able. But just it isn't simply a one-way process. You know, these notions of knowledge transfer or transmission, they're all problematic for me because they're all linear and all unidirectional. But all of those issues are up for grabs, it seems to me. And then if we think differently about this exchange that's going back and forward, and not just between me and students, student and me, but between students, if we think about this and think about the different positioning of students in relation to the learning experience, what does that mean then our classrooms might look like? Now, these are really difficult and thorny issues. Many academics throw their hands up in despair and say, it's too difficult, I go back to what I know. It's beholden on us to help them to see how to be different, how to teach in a different way. And indeed, it's beholden on them as academics in the field. They can't just say, well, I only teach bright young things that come through my door. I don't want anyone else. Our responsibility as a public institution is to provide that education to the society in which we're located. That includes everyone that's out there. So these are really difficult and thorny issues, and I encourage you to think through them, and I'm pleased to hear that you're trying to approach them. It isn't simply about fixing the literacy problems of this student has come in. It's also about how we do the teaching, and what teaching is, and what learning is.
Follow up on that question, because one of the things that we're wrestling with is the problem of, just on this particular issue of when the students are here and changing the way teaching and learning is thought about, is how inordinately difficult it is in higher education to change the way academics think. I've spoken to Sally Kift, you know, who's done such amazing things. But if you are, no matter how good the work you do and well-respected, unless your institution has got all these levers lined up which it will pull simultaneously, you can go forward for 2 years and then back for 10. I mean, it's very... that to get that really big shift in the practice of everybody is the hardest thing to do, really. I mean, it's peculiarly difficult.
You're right, but I think there's actually a particular moment. At this particular moment, there's an opportunity. And if I was being facetious, I'd send them all to grade three. And I used to be a grade three teacher at one stage of my life. And trying to do creative writing and being the person that had to respond to all their writing and having this enormous line, and lunchtime is approaching and I've still got this line, you understand very clearly that you can't teach in that didactic mode with just you relating to individual students. You can't do it. It's physically impossible, let alone problematic in terms of the teaching style. So, you know, if I was being facetious, say, throw them all into grade three and find out what it's like, life is like there, learn about teaching and then come back. But I do think there is a strategic moment now when people are thinking about these issues, they're raised, they're concerned, they're genuinely concerned, and I think we need to deal with their genuine concerns and help them move forward with some of them, offer them some of the models that we know that are there. You've mentioned Sally Kiff's work, who I know well, also the work of the Teaching and Learning Research Program at the Institute of Education in London, are offering ways of or principles upon which we might build our teaching practice that could look different in different places and indeed in different discipline areas or in different courses. But these are pointers, if you like, towards this direction. And if we can open up the conversations between the academics, they're smart, intelligent people. We've got to trust that and help them with the tools that we have to help them move forward. So dialogue, I think, is probably one of the ways that we can might approach that.
Any further questions? If not, I'll just take this opportunity to thank Trevor. You've emphasised both complexity and the huge, in a sense, breadth of challenge that the sector is facing. That if we try to partition the issue of equity into it's just that the problem is the end to score, or the problem is raising aspirations, or the problem is whatever, we're going to fail. It needs to be an end-to-end
Indeed, this is not a politician's solution.
and therefore, it's going to be it's going to be long drawn out. It will be time consuming. It will be expensive. And I think it is still not yet clear that governments or indeed university administrators and vice chancellors have recognised quite how expensive this will be. And given attention to the resources that would be required, it's also a case that, in a sense, where well, the good thing about it is that the government has set out the
the destination for us, in at least in terms of the 2040 targets. We know where we want to get to. The problem is we don't have a map. We don't have the clear routes, or we have many pathways, and some of them are going to turn out to be dead ends because there's a lot of experimentation going on. And in a sense, we sort of have an overdetermined problem. We say, well, yeah, we've got this problem about low participation amongst various identified groups. There are 1,001 things that we could do, indeed 1,001 things that are happening across the sector, and then all examples from the rest of the world. But we don't. There is some research. There are still many initiatives that are not researched, and it would be possible for a university or a number of universities to completely commit to a whole range of plausible strategies that end up delivering very little by way of outcomes. So it seems to me that there's a real need for serious research, and I would say for some conscious experiments. So what I hope the government will do is encourage different universities or groups of universities to try different things. Not to, as typically happens with public policy, to sort of dragoon everyone towards doing the same thing or the same sort of thing, but let's have quite a lot of variety, a lot of differentiation, state by state and university by university, in trying to meet some of the equity targets and the participation targets. Let's have serious structures in terms of analysis of performance and see how we perform, and also try to work out what is transferable and what is institution and place specific, because what may work in one place or for one group may not work elsewhere. Something that, as a university, we for instance, have a unique opportunity. Just up the road, an old secondary school has been flattened, and as part of the state government's education policy for the north of Melbourne, they're building a new prep to year 12 school. It's going to have a particular emphasis on maths and science, but it will be a generalist school. It's not a special entry school. It's a school for the general population, mainly serving West Heidelberg, which is a low SES postcode area, low rates of continuation to higher education. Now, we have and the state government wants us to work in partnership with that school. This is a school where we can clearly have both the science faculty and the education faculties working closely with the teachers. But we could do all sorts of things. I mean, in terms of intervention at the youngest possible age, I mean, we could do all sorts of things in terms of making sure that every parent and every pupil at that school is teamed up with mentors. I mean, after all, we've got 20,000 students on this campus. Now, if we can't staff comprehensive after-school care and support, homework clubs and the like, from within the university to serve to that school, then, in a sense, there's not much hope for these partnerships that you want to build. But we could see the extent to which putting in a lot of resource in an adjacent school can transform the outcomes for the kids going through that school. Just one example, and actually very easy to do because it's adjacent, it takes, 5 minutes to get there. I think we have this great opportunity to do that and to be really serious, to establish a longitudinal social science research project around that school and the teachers in the school, the parents and the pupils, to see what impact we have. And then to try to work out what of this is transferable, what would we and others be capable of doing, perhaps at lower cost with lower intensity, because we can have high intensity input into that school. But that's a sort of experiment that I think we should commit to, and we can do it with a number of other schools in the local area here and in the catchments around our other campuses across regional Victoria. And I suspect we will find that some of the things that we think are great actually turn out not to be terribly important, effective, or valued by teachers, parents, or pupils. And I'm certain that's the case because, despite all our best intentions, we continue to be in the higher education sector a very sort of producer-driven sector. We still tend to, you know, whether it's in teaching, whether it's how we deliver teaching, how we deliver administration and support to students, we tend to think, this is what we think you would like, this is what we think you would benefit from. We're not a terribly sort of consumer-focused sector, despite all the surveys that we do. We still, in a sense, we know best. And perhaps to attain some of the goals that you've set out, we need a sort of change in our mindset to put the student first, not necessarily just as a disembodied student, but the student and her or his context first, and to try to think through the educational experience from the perspective of the individuals who work their way through the educational system, rather than from the perspective of the institutions that provide the educational services. So, Trevor, you've outlined the scale of the task before us, the scale of the task before everyone involved in education in Australia, including our paymasters in government. As you say, no easy answers, and so possibly not the sort of talk politicians would like, but certainly one that we have really valued. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And
thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.